It's the great Dante Read Through.
It's the great Dante Read Through, where we are reading through all of the comic strip, The Adventures of Nicolai Dante. Co-created by Robbie Morrison and Simon Fraser from the weekly science fiction anthology comic, 2000 AD.
I'm Simon Fraser.
And I'm Edie Nugent, freelance writer and Simon's wife. Join us as we swashbuckle our way through the Russian Empire of the future. Warning, there will be spoilers. We will be talking in depth about these comics, so if you haven't read them yet, listen at your own risk. To join our book club and read along with us, go to shop.2000ad.com to pick up the books in hard copy or digital.
Today we're reading The Romanov Empire, found in Prague's 1250 to 1262.
Hi, Simon.
Hi, Edie.
Hello, irregulars, and welcome back to The Great Dante Read-Through. Today we are diving into the first part of The Romanov Empire.
It's a big one, folks.
Yes, so we're going to be dividing it in half. So yes. This is part one. So, The Romanov Empire. We open on a bird's eye view of some Romanov Seahawks engaging in a battle with some robot defenses in the waters outside of St. Petersburg.
Let's do our credits first, remember.
Oh, so okay. Sorry.
Yes.
Go ahead.
Before the summary. So,
who wrote it? Written, who drew it?
Written
who
by colored? Robbie Morrison, of course.
Right.
All of the art in this 12-episode epic is by John Burns and is lettered by Annie Parkhouse. Now, I have to confess at the beginning here, like, when I saw the lineup ahead of, like, and I read Romanov Empire. I was like, what's that? I don't remember that. What is that story? I don't remember any of it.
You didn't remember any of it.
And I'm like, did I read this or not? I don't know. And I assume I read it. I'm not exactly sure where I was in my life at the time. It's possible I was like moving country or something. And I don't know. Anyway, having read it now, I'm going, some of this is familiar for sure. And I know the plot points. So they may have been explained to me on the phone. But I may not have actually read the comic at the end. I don't know. Anyway, I did read it, and I enjoyed it a lot, so here we go.
Yes. So, you know, before I go back, it's like we're finally getting our conclusion for all of the suffering we've endured in the war, both us watching people die and the many people dying and compromising of character.
Yes.
And so this begins, as I was saying, with a bird's eye view of some Seahawks that are engaging in this battle with some robot defenses in the waters outside of St. Petersburg.
So what's really interesting about this is, I don't know if Robbie actually wrote Ekranoplan anywhere in this. I don't think he did. But Ekranoplans, which are basically airplanes that use the surface effect over water to fly. So they don't fly, they fly like a couple of feet above the water, but they can't fly in the air. They can't like soar, but they can fly above the water very fast. So these are Ekranoplans, which is a very Russian thing. And the Soviet Union spent a lot of money developing Ekranoplans during the Cold War. But that's not a technology that was ever really developed anywhere else. So it's really interesting to do this. This is a very Russian thing. These planes which fly above the water. Anyway.
That's very cool.
I thought so.
Yeah, I had no idea.
Google it and you can see these incredible, crazy airplanes which don't fly up in the air. They just fly above water. So they're like really, really fast sort of flying boat things. Amazing.
That's crazy. So basically this is where the Tsar, St. Petersburg is where the Tsar has withdrawn to mount what's termed as a last desperate defense, right? And it's also mentioned in a voiceover from Tsar Roars, again, the Georgi Lukasovich book.
Indeed.
That we will hear lots more from.
The immortal Georgi Lukasovich.
Yes, as we go through this story. A new ruling coat of arms was raised across the land, and we have this close-up. Page before here on the double-headed eagle of the Romanov crest that's on a Seahawk wing. So it's kind of setting the tone here that perhaps this assault is going to gain some ground.
So there's some sort of little technical note here. The double-headed eagle is, in the story, is used as the symbol of the Romanov family, the way I initially drew it. The problem is that there was no story Bible written for this because it wasn't planned to be drawn by multiple artists originally. And there was no time or money put towards putting together a story Bible so that multiple artists could like understand all the various iconography. Iconographies of the thing. So the original Romanov eagle was the symbol of the Romanov family, but I stripped it of the crown because the Romanov family were not the imperial family. And now that they have decided to take over, have rebelled against the Makarovs, they've now reinstated the crown above the double-headed eagle. Unfortunately, the other artists who came in drawing this were not informed of this. I'm not sure what, I don't know, I didn't talk to anyone directly about it. And I don't think it came through editorial, but the Romanov double-headed eagle ends up being the symbol of everyone's houses. The Makarovs use them, Steve Yule did it, and John Burns does it, uses the Romanov double-headed eagle, which is wrong, because the Makarovs had a raven, the raven, which is their symbol. And
Hence the raven core, as I discovered.
And there's two like heraldic symbols, the double-headed eagles, the Makarovs, the Romanovs, and the Makarovs go the got this kind of like scythe kind of raven logo, which I put on the faces of the raven core.
Right.
But as we will discover in this story, John Burns and I have various differing opinions on design, which I will highlight as we go forward.
Okay. Well, here we go. So Dante is leading this Seahawk offense. Because as we remember from his chat earlier with Dimitri, the irregulars now have the honor of leading every offensive in the war now.
I like how the infantry are suddenly now like the naval air force too. Like what?
Everything.
Suddenly they fly planes?
Yeah, they can do it all.
Amazing.
Yeah. Spatchcock and Flintlock are teamed up in a Seahawk, with the latter retching repeatedly from the stench of his co-pilot or the quick maneuvering of the craft. It's unclear. Dante and Elena are piloting another Seahawk, and then we have Boris Grozny and Ursa together in a third seaplane. So we're cutting back and forth between these Seahawks. And apparently we learn that the water is full of sharks as well, with mantis sharks with a taste for human flesh.
Indeed. There's just kind of another wrinkle here. If it's mentioned here, I'm trying to think. There's a reference here which I've got to pick up. To Patrick O'Brien, which is in here. Ah, yeah, sorry.
You're going way too far ahead, honey.
No, we'll get to that in a minute.
We'll get there.
Next, a few pages.
Okay. Right. So we've got these sharks. While we're cutting back and forth between these different planes, mm-hmm. Dante tries to get a dig in on Ursa's size again, calling mm-hmm. her too much of a mouthful for the sharks. Mm-hmm. And Ursa finally gets a comeback in, saying big is beautiful, and that he shouldn't knock it till he's tried it. And I just want to say that I want to just, like, whisk Ursa away from all this madness and, like, take her to a Lizzo concert. like, let's leave these sad men to their silly war, you know? It's about damn time, Ursa.
She's poorly served.
She really is. But the irregular sea offensive starts to lose badly, unfortunately. And Dante and his team end up in the water.
Yeah.
And of course, because there are sharks, we get a Jaws popping out of the water jump scare reference before Dante destroys the shark with a smile, you son of a bitch line.
Yeah, that's,
Yes.
Straight out of Deep Blue Sea or something like that.
But you know what? No, it's not Deep Blue Sea. It's Jaws, babe. This is 100% Jaws.
But there's the crap one.
Yes, I know about the crap one, but this is 100% Jaws. Yeah. We're only doing Jaws here.
Okay.
And damn, Jaws is a good movie. Like, as I was reading this, I was like, okay, we're doing Jaws. And then I just really wanted to watch Jaws after this.
We saw Jaws recently.
I know. It wasn't that recently.
A couple of years. I mean, we showed it to my kid.
We did show it to your kid. But I feel like that's a few years ago. I would watch Jaws every year. That's one of those movies I would watch.
Okay. Well, it's a good movie.
I love Jaws. It's so good.
It stands up very, very well.
Yes. Anyway.
These mantis sharks are a little disappointing.
Why are they disappointed?
Well, they're too sharky.
They're more sharky than the manta.
Yes.
Yeah. I mean, they're kind of serpentine in their body a little bit, but...
Apparently their aliens have been imported just to defend the Baltic.
Yes, they've been imported.
Baltic sharks.
So basically, just when the Tsar's sea defensives kind of have the... irregulars on the ropes, we discover that their offensive was merely a cover so that the Romanov forces could plant explosives around the base of the Tsar's Baltic fortress.
They should really be wise to this by now, because pretty much every time Dante appears, he's a distraction.
He's a distraction.
Because he is a distraction.
He's very distracting.
He's very distracting. Yes. Everyone gets like, oh, Dante, kill him. And it's like, they ignore all the other stuff that's going on.
So anyway, this works, and the base explodes mightily. Yes. And none other than Andreas emerges from the waters beneath our team in a submarine, kind of pushes up and is underneath the irregulars.
And the quote here, Robbie's fictional quote is, the destruction of the fortress and the resulting tidal wave devastated St. Petersburg's sea defenses, leaving the city vulnerable to rebel alliance. Forward to Seahawks by Patrick Aubrey, which is a reference, of course, to Patrick O'Brien's Master and Commander series. Aubrey is the captain of the ship. Jack Aubrey.
Did you read those books?
I've read a couple of them, yeah. Really? I have all of them because my father was a huge fan of them. So he bought all of them. And I had for a period of time... because he used to buy them when he went on vacation. So every time he came to visit me, he brought a new Master and Commander book. So I had half the set, and the other half of the set were at my parents' house. So it took a long time for me to unite the two sets of books into one complete set. So I'm going to read them all one day.
You really should.
I've read the first few, and they're great, of course.
Of course they are.
Anyway, so yes, Patrick Aubrey is a reference to Patrick O'Brien. Right. And yes...
Andreas shows up and saves the day, saves the irregulars from drowning amidst the sharks, and he scoops them up on his submarine and begins hitting on Elena inappropriately.
Yes,
and I love how Elena reminds him that she's been in trouble twice now for killing superior officers. Yeah.
Yes.
Yes. And then Dante and Andreas make a wager on whether Andreas can make Elena fall for his charms, quote, and the loser is going to pay for the winner to spend 3 months at the House of Sin.
3 months.
Three months. Okay. If they could even survive, truly.
Yes.
It strikes me how similar Andreas and Dante are. Like, it's commented on in this story as well.
Mm-hmm.
But not only are they both, like, womanizers with a flair for the dramatic, but, like, they both have bioblades as their power.
Okay, this is a problem because this is... it wasn't supposed to be this way. John has drawn Andreas with bioblades like Dante, and that's not how... Andreas's bioblades work. They were thrown. They were specifically thrown.
Yeah, it's kind of like force fields blades. Well, they could expand as big or as small as he wants.
Yeah, they're the same as Dante's, but they're projectile weapons.
Right.
Whereas Dante's are attached to his
hands. Out of his hands,
But that's not how John Burns draws them here, which is, I think, a mistake, I'll be honest with you. Again, it's possibly not mentioned explicitly in the script. It just says, with bioblades, he destroys a bunch of people. And that's kind of, they're not the right bioblades.
Got you.
Frankly.
Well, meanwhile.
And while I'm digging on John Burns, what is going on with the palace?
It's a little flat in the front, isn't it?
It's bizarre.
I mean, here's what I'm thinking with this.
Yeah.
It's sort of destroyed right now. Like, we're back in St. Petersburg, the Tsar's licking his wounds, and robots are repairing the Imperial Space Egg Palace. Mm-hmm. So my feeling is, and maybe I'm no prizing here, because it's been sort of defeated somewhat and it's sort of propped up and being repaired, it's not at its full, like, puffy glory.
Here's something interesting about... what we have going on here, which is two artists working on one comic, both with strong opinions and very differing design senses. So John Burns, at various points in the story, just decides that he doesn't like the design of what's going on, and he designs his own version of it. And this version of the Imperial Palace is his own version, and it's nothing to do with mine. It's loosely based on it, but it's a complete... I'm sorry, but it's a mess. It's just no... mine was kind of like a cross between a Fabergé egg and a Mobius thing.
Space egg.
This is some kind
of... That looks like a giant cushion.
It looks like a giant throw cushion.
Yeah.
And I'm like, no, it's just not good. Sorry, John Burns fans. I'm going to dig on John Burns again here because we have other design issues.
We'll get there. We're not there yet.
No, but this is literally the next two pages. John Burns decided he didn't like the Ravencore design I did, and he redesigned the Ravencore into these guys wearing soup bowls on their heads. And he also
We have not gotten there yet.
We'll get to that character yet.
Simon,
carry on.
I gotta rein you in.
I've got to say, I don't generally love all my designs. They're usually done under time pressure, so it's like I do the best I can do. I did like the Tsar's Palace. I'm always very fond of that, and I like the way it developed over the story. And I really was very happy with the Ravencore design. And that's something I really liked. It was right. one of the key design decisions.
So it grinds your gears a little bit to see these weird redesigned. Yes, because
it does.
You are very hard on yourself and your own art, and you're actually saying you liked these things, which is very unusual for you to say.
Indeed.
It should be said.
Indeed.
And it should be said that all art is opinion.
Yes.
And this is your opinion.
Sure.
Right? Other people coming to it may think the opposite. You just
I'm getting positive feedback from all these people saying when I'm getting a bit digging into this. Anyway, back to the double-headed eagle here.
Yeah.
You can see behind the czar here.
That's true.
We've got a double-headed eagle.
I didn't even notice that. Yeah, it shouldn't be there.
That's incorrect.
Because we are back in St. Petersburg with the czar, so it's not right. double-headed eagle.
No.
But as I was saying, the czar is licking his wounds,
yes.
right?
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And we're at the Space Egg. We're near the Space Egg Palace, in the Space Egg Palace. Can't quite mm-hmm. tell where mm-hmm. we're at this point, but somewhere internally in the stronghold of mm-hmm. the Imperials here. Jenna and the Tsar's superior officers are discussing their increasingly desperate position.
I do like his uniform on Jenna here. I think the way he designs the hat is great. And I think he's got Jenna looking really good here.
Jenna does look good.
Yeah.
So they're discussing their position and mm-hmm. that air support, crucially, is yeah. 3 days away, right?
Right.
And meanwhile, the Romanov forces are already ready to storm the city, and mm-hmm. they don't have their air support.
Yeah.
So this is causing dissension amongst the ranks of the superior officers against the Tsar, with mm-hmm. Admiral Klebanov arguing that they should negotiate peace with the Romanov forces because mm-hmm. their backs are against the wall.
Yeah.
And the Tsar takes this about as well as you can imagine,
mm-hmm.
telling Klebanov and his supporters that they've lost their edge and to report to Count Pyre for combat duty as cannon fodder. Which is actually kind of kind, considering that they are questioning the Tsar as superior officers. I think mm-hmm. cannon fodder is kind. He's usually even more mm-hmm. Cutthroat than that. But then there's this bald guy who's just never named that I can tell,
mm-hmm.
But has obviously thrown his lot in with Klebanov and kills the guards that are flanking where the Tsar is sitting.
Right.
Right? And then the Admiral shoves Jenna to the floor and presses his gun to her head.
Classic Tsar here, sitting completely impassively while chaos erupts around him, because he seems to be, or he feels completely invulnerable, obviously.
He's so chill here that I thought like he might be a hologram for a minute, like he wasn't actually there because he's just so relaxed, but no, he actually is there.
Not afraid,
and just as it's looking bad for the Makarovs, an android of some kind, here you go, Simon,
mm-hmm.
appears and blasts the weapon out of the bald dude's hand, and the Tsar introduces the masked droid to the traitorous officers as his warlord.
Yes.
And the warlord kills all the officers with several well-aimed blasts from his hands. I can't tell really what kind of blast,
mm-hmm.
but you wanted to talk about the warlord. So here we are. We made it.
Yeah. Yeah. We didn't like that very much.
Yeah.
Sorry. No.
It's a little bit Robbie the Robot.
It's a bit
kind
Robbie
of,
the Robot.
It?
It's a bit goofy looking.
Like old school sci-fi.
Well, yeah, that's the thing. It's like we wanted John Burns because he is old school sci-fi, but at the same note, we kind of, you have to kind of mix it up a bit. And this is a clunky old
thing. Well, the warlord looks a little too fun, to be honest. He's supposed to be like kind of really evil.
Kind of goofy. He's got the kind of like hawk face sort of thing, but it doesn't really
kind mm-hmm.
of, it's a bit goofy.
Well.
And I was told, please, could you change this?
Change it. So okay.
All right. Sure.
We'll
destroy it and then start again. I did actually destroy in story, though, so I didn't like change it for no reason. I did. We did actually destroy it.
Spoiler, Simon.
Well,
you have not gotten there yet.
Okay, there.
All right. You're the worst sometimes.
I'm talking about it.
We'll talk about it when we get there.
Mm-mm.
I'm trying to keep some kind of control on this, sir.
Mm.
Mm. So we cut back to the Romanov camp, where the irregulars are preparing for what is expected to be the final assault on St. Petersburg.
Mm-hmm.
And Dante is sitting around being emo and drinking.
Mm-hmm.
And Elena kicks Dante in the ass to go inspire the troops, at least bring him some alcohol. She tells him the troops follow him, not the Romanov cause. And that's interesting, right?
Yeah,
I mean, for some reason, they're following him. He's inspired loyalty at this
mm-hmm.
point. And Jen, she kind of talks about how she was bred for war since she was a child, and she's going to find another cause to fight for if they manage to survive
mm-hmm.
this assault. And then Dante kind of wonders if he can even go back to who he was before the war.
Mm-hmm.
So I kind of liked this little moment with him and Elena. It was just sort of a little beat, which we don't get a lot of in
mm-hmm.
this whole war storyline, of them
yeah.
kind of just not having these huge thoughts of, you know, good and evil
mm-hmm.
and who's on the right side, but just like, how do we go, what are we going to do after this thing if we manage to live? Which I think was interesting.
Elena has a useful position with Dante because she's the one he can talk to about everything, about the emotional issues too. She's his equal and he respects her. So they have this kind of very close bond, but it's strictly in terms of the business at hand. Because she's all business.
I really do like that he's like never hits on Elena. It's very interesting to me. Hmm. I mean, maybe he will later, but like certainly not through any of this.
Maybe it says something about his attitude towards women. He doesn't hit on a woman he respects that much.
Well, I mean, could be that. Or, you know, I mean, I don't know. I think there could be a lot of reasons for this. Mm-hmm. I mean, he did sort of free Elena when she was being like tied up and people were attempting to like sexually assault her. And we know how Dante feels about that. So
and her whole thing is for executing her commanding officer that hit on her. So
that's
a bad idea.
I didn't even think about that. Oh my God. I just said it earlier. That would be maybe lethal for Dante. Because even though he's a cad, he does have a very strong self-preservation instinct.
Indeed.
And so then as Dante makes to booze up the troops, we see Andreas attempt to woo Elena with a giant display of flowers and a trip to drink champagne and take in the Aurora Borealis.
It had to be said, talking about the artwork again, John Burns really likes Elena Kurakin as a character.
Mm.
He really enjoys doing her. He paints.
He really does her time. Beautifully, doesn't
she's
he?
She's always a little bit more. And the thing is, he's painting at this stage, so he's not doing the line work. He's kind of moved into full painted artwork, fully semi-painted artwork a lot of the time, but fully painted most of the time. It's a remarkable piece of work to do this much artwork. Painted because it's a lot of work, and he does a fantastic job with it.
It's pretty superhuman.
But he's really lavishing attention on characters. You can tell the characters he loves because he spends time on them. Elena's obviously one. There's other characters he has more trouble with, specifically Dmitry Romanov. He's very weird on Dmitry Romanov. I don't quite understand. We'll come to that later. I'll point it out. Dmitry Romanov is sort of mercurially changing all
the
time.
He does kind of change,
and he's sort of weirdly soft and vague, and it's like, I don't know, he never really gets a handle on Dmitry. Yeah. I don't know why. It's an odd one, because I deliberately designed all the Romanov kids to look sort of similar, and Andreas and Dmitry, and they're all kind of related. They all have a similar kind of face, but he doesn't kind of get that, and his Andreas varies between that and somehow something more heroic, and some of it can be a little bit vague, but
yeah, he does. I did notice that as we were going through that he did wonderful things with Elena.
Yes.
And her face is so expressive.
Yeah.
And she just looks like a real person.
Yes.
Like not only does she, you know, Jenna looks beautiful, but Elena looks so real. Like this is like somebody he actually knows in life or something.
Right.
It's really nice. Mm-hmm. So Andreas shows up to attempt to woo Elena with this giant display of flowers. And then Elena sets it on fire.
Cheesily inappropriate.
Yes. Sets it on fire. And the troops gather around the flames for a drink, which I love.
Right.
And to take a picture for a war photographer. And that doesn't seem at all darkly prophetic.
Yeah.
There's this snapshot of all the irregulars in a line and Spatchcock's hanging his butt out and everybody's there. Clearly. And Dante is raising his bottle up in the air.
Clearly the beginning of the end.
Yes, very much so. Yeah,
foreshadowing.
And we cut from this jovial scene right into the irregulars screaming through the streets of St. Petersburg, which
great
are choked
shot,
with choke smoke
really
and explosions.
Really good shot.
Yeah.
I don't know, maybe you got a reference shot for this, but the lighting on that and the composition is just fantastic. Yeah. I was looking at it earlier and going, wow, that is on point.
Mm-hmm.
And then the panel below has got this.
Yeah, and the sort of like the moonlight or the flashes from the bombs sort of stretching these shadows across the ground. Really nice. And Dante takes out a bunch of enemy soldiers in a rather spectacular fashion, all while lamenting a hangover, which is very Dante.
Again, another Burns design note is that Burns has got the sword, the bio blades coming from Dante's fingers straight out from the hand, whereas I drew them crossways. So basically like a saber or a sort of like a cutlass, whereas Burns has got them coming like extensions of the fingers, which I don't like because it's a weak position. The wrist is the weakness there.
Mm.
And if you're hitting somebody, you want the wrist to be rigid. But if you're flapping your hands around with knives on your fingers, it doesn't really work. It's not a strong stabbing position anyway, or hacking position.
Yes, that's interesting.
It also looks a bit, I mind it looks a little weak.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, in any event, Dante runs into Ursa, who is cradling the dead body of a soldier whose brains she's just smashed out.
Yeah.
And here we have kind of a more dramatic version of the scene that we just had with Elena before,
mm-hmm.
where Ursa is asking Dante how they will live with the things they've done in wartime if they live to see the end of the battle.
Oh, God, everyone's saying goodbye.
Yes.
These are all goodbye scenes.
These are goodbye scenes. And Dante vows to look after his troops after the war is done and thanks Ursa for saving his life and gives her a kiss.
He does a good job with Ursa, too, actually.
He does. He does Ursa really well.
She's well really well painted, mm-hmm. well drawn.
And but of course this kiss feels like the Godfather kiss to me, right? This cannot be good.
It's the last time we'll see it. We'll see Ursa again.
Later, mm-hmm. Dante and Dimitri are back at Romanov Mobile Command, and Dimitri tells Dante to let Elena lead the offensive against the Imperial Palace.
Mm-hmm.
And Dante refuses to sit and sip champagne while his troops die. He protests this, though it's hard to see why he thinks Dimitri would be using the irregulars for anything else at this point. I mean, you know.
Expecting anything from Dimitri at this point and like snarling bastard at him is like kind of beside the point. I mean, we know that Dimitri's a piece of shit. He's never been anything other than a piece of shit.
The definition of insanity is doing things over and expecting a different result.
It's like, why are you even bothering with Dimitri? He's a one-note character.
It does seem like a waste of time.
He's completely, resolutely shitty in every single thing. There's not even one moment where he sort of like pats his dog.
Nope.
Nothing. Dimitri is a shit at every level.
Well,
we're
going to get like one moment much later.
Okay.
And I'll remind you when we get there. It's going to be in the second part of this.
Yeah.
But anyway, Dimitri tells Dante that if his troops retreat, if the irregulars retreat at any point,
mm-hmm.
regardless of what's going on, he's commanded his other forces to fire on them and kill them.
Yeah. Okay. Great.
Great.
Thanks for that.
Thank you.
Again,
so,
Dimitri's kind of like a weird blob here.
Yeah.
He's just disappearing.
Meanwhile, in the space egg, mm-hmm. a commanding officer tells a subordinate that the rebels have routed all of the Romanov street defenses. All of the Makarov street defenses and are massing to attack.
That's quite an achievement. Doing a street-to-street warfare is very slow mm-hmm. and time-consuming. So to route all of the defense forces like that is like, wow, fast work.
So he's basically saying this other officer should summon the Tsar and Jenna and that this is the beginning of the end.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So the Makarov father-daughter team then spy the irregulars mm-hmm. making to charge the palace grounds, I guess. The grounds below the palace.
Always at the front,
it
never
is
killed.
Floating, I don't know. Yes, and Jenna gives the order to fire, but seems to take no pleasure in it,
mm-hmm.
and the irregulars are blown apart.
Supposedly.
But
not, they never die.
And then Dimitri and Arkady look on, sipping that champagne
mm-hmm.
that Dimitri talked about, and Arkady muses that they should send in the Romanov Eagles to give air support to the troops, but apparently that's not stylish enough for Dimitri, and stylish is a bunch of people dying.
I love how he feels like guilty about feeding champagne to his kid while he's watching people be massacred. It's like, what? Priorities, dude. Priorities.
Well, I also think it's interesting here that Arkady kind of has a heart, and that he's like, why don't we send in air support? Like, why are all these people needlessly dying?
Mm-hmm.
You know, he's sort of questioning him.
Well, as we're going to find out, Arkady is, you know.
Well, listen.
Things are happening with Arkady.
They are, yes, but not really yet.
Mm-hmm.
Back on the ground, we see Ursa's leg has been blown apart by this mm-hmm. blast that Jenna ordered. Elena wants to retreat, and Dante explains they can't or they'll be killed by their
own
side.
Again, the fat gags. Takes a bigger shell than that to kill somebody my size.
She's digging on herself now.
Putting herself down.
Yeah. Here's the thing. Mm-hmm. There's sort of an empowerment disempowerment thing,
mm-hmm.
and like if you are making the jokes,
mm-hmm.
it's also she's making them from a joke of strength. Like I'm too big and powerful for that shell to take me apart. So it's kind of like, you know what I mean? She's like, fat is beautiful, basically. Big
mm-hmm.
is beautiful. So it's like it's a position of power. It's definitely an improvement, I will say, over previous jokes that you know I felt a lot about.
Sure.
But in any event, the Tsar then orders a ceasefire and tells Jenna to send in the Raven Corps to kill the surviving troops, right? The surviving Romanov troops. And the Raven Corps march in to do just that and then freeze
The Raven Corps.
you're having problems with this panel where we see the Raven Corps looking.
Design, it just, no.
It looks like the
Buckethead Boys.
Carlos Esquerra like helmet almost.
Yeah.
You know?
I kind of Trigon Empire-ish. I don't know. It's
yeah,
it's really.
It's different.
No.
It's different.
No.
So in any event, The Raven Corps marches in to kill the remaining troops and then frees as Nikolai threatens them with his bloodied bioblades. And just when Dante is thinking that he's managing to intimidate the Raven Corps, he turns to see his superpowered siblings amassed behind him. So we have Andreas, Lulu in her cute little uniform coat, Nastasia and Victor are there to lend their crests to this fight. And so then the siblings begin to inflict some major damage. Lulu's cyber-organic minions lay waste to swaths of Raven Corps, and Andreas's bio-blade energy field takes out many more. What's going on with his face, but...
I mean, he's doing a lot of work.
He's lit up. He's
Bruce Forsyth there.
Nastasia then spits acid on some more unfortunates. And Victor just kind of strolls through the war field looking scary. I don't know. He doesn't really do anything.
Coat. Another great coat.
Yes, with a super great coat. And another Tsar Wars, Georgi Lukasevich voiceover states that the family Romanov in battle look as if gods walked the earth. Vengeful gods, and to defeat them would require a deal with the devil. And so right on cue, the warlord shows up, looking all bionic and shiny and faceless. And Nastasia steps forward to melt him with her disgusting vomit acid. But warlord raises a metal hand and a pulse fries her into a screaming, bleeding corpse.
Right.
Really disgusting death here for her.
Very unpleasant.
Very unpleasant. And I love this part, by the way, how the voiceover tells us that the, quote, family Romanov had never before faced their own mortality. And I'm excuse me, Alexander and Alexandra from episode one of this podcast?
Dante's killed a couple of them.
The incest twins, they didn't face their mortality then?
Yeah, I think they've been kind of forgotten about
totally
it. They
got forgotten about. Nobody cares. They were literally incest twins who became a double-headed monster and were sleeping together and nobody remembers them. No. There's so much about them that was memorable. And everyone's just like, meh.
Yeah, those guys. Remember what these guys were called?
Arkady looks on helplessly from safety as Dimitri claims the armor of this warlord is modeled on a white army reaver.
Right.
The warrior elite of the beings who created the weapons crest technology, as we found out in episode 5 of the podcast, the Gulag Apocalyptic.
So he's not riffing on my design sense. He's riffing on Henry Flint, which is even more weird because imagine John Burns trying to do Henry Flint. That's not happening.
Right. And so that was when Nikolai's pantsless Lady Kara, who gave him the huntsman and a great coat.
A great coat.
Super great. And she was one of these alien beings that established this tech. So this is the same tech he's seeing on this warlord, which is going to become important later. Lulu sends her cyber creatures to engage the warlord with no success. He burns them like he did her sister. And various other siblings engage the warlord with a similar lack of success. When suddenly Imperial Dreadnoughts are in the sky, but wait a minute, they were supposed to be 3 days away, right? And the Tsar tells his astonished daughter, Jenna, that he lied about them being 3 days away because he knew he couldn't trust his superior officers not to leak this info. This was his fake out. He basically feinted his troops in order to draw in the Romanov forces and then destroy them.
Yes.
Okay. Which is a pretty good move, to be honest.
Right. I would like to draw attention to, it gives me no pleasure to say this, the worst panel of this whole story, which is the bottom of this page here.
Oh.
Drawing the Roman, the Makarovs, the Strike Hawk things, whatever they call
them. The Strike Hawks, those are the Raven Wings.
This is to underline my point earlier that John M. Burns does not like to draw my designs at all. And these are this is horrible.
It does kind of look like a really Roomba or something. Awful.
And he's like, it's just breaking up. It's not even it doesn't work at all. He's not having fun with this at all. But he has to draw it because that was the design. So yeah, this is where
did you ever see, now Simon, you've drawn a lot of licensed stuff, right? Yes. So you've drawn a lot of stuff that isn't your own.
Right.
Is there stuff that you hated to draw and kind of cut corners on?
I don't cut corners because a lot of these things with licenses, you have to get it right. Mm. It's important. The thing I really hate to draw, and I'm very sad to say this, is the TARDIS. It's the worst thing to draw. It's just so boring. It's a box, and you have to draw it again and again and again. And the dodge for that is to get a 3D model and do it that way. But I'm like, I didn't want to do that at the time. I really should have done, because consistency is what it's all about with drawing something like that. Though I did have a scene with Doctor Who where I actually had Doctor Who, or the Doctor, acting against the TARDIS, and the TARDIS was somehow... you feel it responding. So I had to make this large wooden box somehow emote, which is a challenge. I don't know if I succeeded in achieving, but I'm like, I gave it my all. But yeah, the TARDIS is very tedious to draw. And spaceships, by and large, are difficult to design. Because you have to, there's a lot of things to consider, and a lot of them, you know, in the future, if you go at it rationally, things are going to look like they were designed by Johnny Ive. They're going to design very simple, clear shapes, and everything's going to look roughly the same. And if you look at the cars outside your window right now, all the cars look roughly the same because they're all designed with the same CAD parameters to the same safety specs. So you're going to, most military equipment looks roughly similar. So yeah, it's kind of difficult to find an interesting design, which is iconic and recognizable. And obviously, John M. Burns and I have differing opinions.
Right.
On this.
Well.
So yeah.
That being said.
Yes.
The dreadnoughts.
I'll stop being bitchy now,
come
I
in, please. Drink your whiskey. The dreadnoughts lay waste to a good number of Romanov troops, and even Dmitri is forced to order a withdrawal, which we know he does not like to do. Mm-hmm. And as Dante shouts to the irregulars to retreat, he spies the Tsar aboard a sort of floating tank of some kind.
Yeah.
And Dante brutally slashes through many enemy soldiers and makes it to the Tsar's craft and is ready to slash the actually scared-looking, maybe the first time we've seen him scared, Tsar's throat when Jenna trains a gun on him and shoots him through the shoulder.
Yeah, great action stuff here.
Yes.
I mean, the movement is very, very compelling.
Truly.
He's very, very good at movement.
Yeah, the battle scenes, which dynamism. Is sort of amazing to have this kind of movement in something that's painted.
I know, it's actually very hard to do. It tends to get kind of, the paint kind of
You would
like,
think it would be muddy.
Yeah, exactly. Maintaining contrasts and strong dynamic lines through it is quite a challenge. He's really good at it.
Yeah, yeah. It's really impressive. Mm-hmm. And the Tsar observes wryly that Jenna didn't fire a killing blow, right? Mm-hmm. Oh, you're so worried for me. You must have missed. But the Ravenclaw are closing in on Dante, making to kill him. Mm-hmm. One of them is raising the butt of his weapon to sort of smash his face in when suddenly Victor appears and rescues him.
Stabs someone with his fingers.
Yeah, he sort of jabs his fingers in his mask, and then he removes his dark glasses to reveal a giant yellow bird eye.
Bird head.
Finally.
And turns into a giant eagle
finally,
thing.
And he transforms into a cyber-organic giant eagle.
Diavolo, screams Dante. He's like, what?
And we're all with you. And his cybernetic claws make short work of the Raven Corps before grabbing Dante and flying him from the battlefield.
Yep.
So this finally. is the big reveal of Victor that we've been waiting for.
This is the big reveal.
There we go. And the Romanovs then regroup back at Rudenstein. A projected screen of the Tsar plays in the town square, warning that the Imperial forces will hunt the Romanov family into extinction, and the House of Romanov and her fiefdoms will be razed to the ground. Mm-hmm. Just then, a bloodied Dante and Victor come through the terrified crowd. One of the crowd says Dante must be too cool to kill, and that they're saved, and Dante looks very weary and unconvincing, an unconvincing threat, shall we
Dante's
say.
Dante's too cool to kill, aren't you, sir? Sir?
Sir? Back at the palace at Rudenstein, Dmitri tells his family that he fears the White Army aliens lended their tech to the Makarovs because he'd stopped sending them genetic materials. That was just like people,
yeah,
right?
The
they
gulag.
Were sending like
yeah, that was
the
gulag.
Gulag. Yeah, people to them as per their arrangement. He needed all his resources for this pointless ground war.
Mm-hmm.
Seems like a totally smart move. Let's just like the aliens that give us this crazy tech that makes us invincible. Let's piss them off. Right before a big war.
Well, I mean,
seems tactically good to me.
It seems like Dmitri's gift is pissing people off.
Yeah. Yep,
it's amazing he's got as many people loyal to him as he has, because he frankly doesn't engender any loyalty whatsoever.
No.
He's just a shit.
Mm-hmm. So everything is terrible for the Romanovs.
Yeah.
The houses that have supported them have withdrawn, their forces are decimated, and Dmitri wants his remaining troops to marshal at the Winter Palace to prepare to battle the Imperials.
Mm-hmm.
Dante is pissed off that Dmitri won't use his troops to save the Rudenstein people and leftover ground troops. And Dmitri is like, did you hang around all this time hoping to change me into some sort of dude who would care about these people like at all?
What?
And he is like, you pissed on our name. I gave you a chance.
Yeah.
Okay. So, of course, Dante is going to stay and fight.
Mm-hmm.
The other Romanovs prepare to leave for the Winter Palace, and Jocasta kisses Dante goodbye. Lulu walks off in a huff. And Dante embraces Victor, which, like, okay, but, you know, I have feelings about this. Like, mm-hmm. why are we hugging Victor so much? Like, this is the guy who, like, murdered and ate a woman. Mm. Like, I know he just saved his life and everything, but, like, you know, the cuddling, anyway.
He's a profoundly weird person.
Yes.
I mean, I always drew Victor as a bit weird and nerdy and socially dissociated. And you're just, like, in the background all the time, like, who the hell is
he
that
He literally
guy?
Ate a woman.
I know.
It's anyway, like, yeah, he ate Octobriana.
He did.
Like, fake Octobriana or whatever she was.
Yeah.
Dante says goodbye to Andreas. And Andreas calls Dante Kolya and ends up staying behind with the Irregulars.
It's an improbably glamour shot there. It's like suddenly he gets really good looking.
Yes, he's very handsome because he's doing the right thing.
So he gets better looking.
So he gets handsomer. Right. Yes. Right. That's a good point of order for everyone. You look handsomer or more beautiful when you're doing the right thing. So there you go. Meanwhile, the Tsar has captured Elena and offers her a position within his army.
Great spitting panel.
Yes,
there.
With Elena Excellent. Responds by spitting on him.
great Elena.
Yep.
And great Tsar. The Tsar looks amazing.
The Tsar looks great. Instead of murdering her on the spot, which really would be the Tsar thing to do. I mean, she's just spit on him. Mm-hmm. He tells Elena he admires her and that she should return to the Irregulars and tell them that Vladimir the Conqueror is coming for them.
Yeah. I'm not loving the handlebar mustache.
Wax
frankly.
Tips
That's a little
on his
silly.
Mustache,
it's not. Very Tsarish to me,
but this is whatever. It. This is where we're ending part one,
yep.
Simon.
Okay.
Okay.
Is it? We're ending
yes,
here?
this is the end of part one.
Goodness.
We are. So what are your thoughts so far?
It's all very big and foreboding and thunderous.
Yes.
Thunderous, I think, is how I would say so far.
I mean, we had the big reveal. I guess Victor was really the big reveal of that first part.
Yeah, I mean, we've been
And then killed Nastasia. That was a big deal.
Yeah, that's true. That's like, yeah.
We lost a sibling.
Substantial, character action.
Yeah. To show us how powerful the warlord is.
Right. You just get the feeling that whole character was there just to prove that point. Because she didn't really have much else to do except be horrible.
I mean, she did. She got some good vomiting all over people.
Yeah.
You know, storylines.
Yeah. I didn't really draw her much at all. I maybe drew her like once or twice, but I didn't draw her like her special introduced the characters segment.
Right.
And I didn't draw her during the war, so she kind of
She sort of passed you by.
I designed her and then she just like disappeared. I don't know.
Well, you know what I thought also before we close the episode is I wanted to share some more feedback from our listeners.
Oh my God.
You mentioned last episode like, oh, did Colin write in? And I said, no, Content Colin did not. But here he comes.
Okay.
Because he is Content Colin. So of course we're going to hear from him.
Okay.
Right. Cool. He really liked last couple of episodes where you kind of got into what was hard for you about the war.
Mm-hmm.
He appreciates that we were open and honest.
Okay.
Right. You know, he talks about kind of the challenge of the artist as a co-creator. Right. And that practically schedule and desire for momentum needs to be maintained, which means the artist whose work takes so much longer has to relinquish control. And say it's basically the writer's story more than your own.
It's a commercial art. And, you know, comics is unique in the sense that there's actually very, very few people involved in doing it, apart from novelists. Novelists are one creator, one job. But for comics, you've got maybe two, three people involved, which is relatively tiny compared to any other visual medium that's nothing. But it has to be done at a commercial pace. So there has to be compromises made to get that to happen. So collaboration... multiple artists, like TV shows, you get multiple directors, multiple teams
writing
of people.
Yeah. Well, his next question is really interesting. He basically said that he wonders if in some utopian world where Dante could have been creator owned, does Simon think he'd have fought harder to take the story and the characters down routes he was more comfortable
thing
with?
Thing is, if it had been creator owned, it wouldn't have been Dante. It would have been something else. Dante was very much designed to be a 2080 thing. If it had been creator-owned, that was going to be the Scottish mercenaries in the time of Peter the Great, which is Robbie's original
pitch.
Oh,
yeah, you were
pitch.
Telling me about this. Can you talk a little bit about this?
I don't know an awful lot about it, frankly. I mean, Robbie explained it to me a long time ago, and I don't have any of the documents.
What were their names?
Keg and Breck.
And they were going to be Scottish mercenaries. This was like an early draft of what later became Dante,
yes,
you said.
Kind of. I think, it may have been a branch which went off its own way. I don't know if Robbie still wants to do that, but it's kind of a short, broad guy and a tall, skinny guy. So it's kind of Spatchcock and Flintlock, but I don't think they were deliberately camping it up as much as those guys do. So that was the plan to basically do a Patrick O'Brien style slice of history through the sort of fake fictional historical story. But that would have been a lot of fun. That would have been the creator's story would have done, the creator-owned story would have done. So Dante wouldn't have existed in any of the circumstances. So yeah, it's a nice thing to think about, but he's not actually remotely whatever would have happened.
So. Yeah. Also something he brought up that I thought was really interesting was the point where you were talking about the final kind of heroic pose that Dante was in after his brutal and terrible fight with Jenna. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And Colin said that for him it really works because he's clearly being horrific.
Mm-hmm.
But Dante has always been about contradictions and kind of the juxtaposition of his actions and the words we read that go with the image works for him. Like he's been terrible, but within all that, there is a hero in Dante somewhere and it's there trying to get out. And in brutal circumstances with the horrible decisions he's made, he doesn't know how to find it. He's not even really looking for it, but it's there somewhere. And the contrast makes the whole thing more powerful to him as a reader.
I appreciate that. And
the heroic pose and the terrible acts.
Yeah, absolutely. Correct. The way I look at these things, and when I see the big pose like that, I kind of can't help but think, how would I have done that? And the way I always approach this kind of, you have to earn the big hero pose and you have to give it meaning. The problem I have with a lot of the way it's done is it's very one note. It's like that's heroic thing. It's very, and I always try and do, there's always a supertext and a subtext to everything. So if you have the hero pose, there's always something else there. You have to have something else going on, which is what makes human beings look like human beings and not just dummies. So to my mind, looking at that sequence, there was so much going on inside Dante and inside Jenna, and the contradiction, the conflicts inside them, as well as between the two of them, were very important. And the way I wanted it to be done, obviously it wasn't done by me, I couldn't draw all of it,
right,
is I want that conflict to be written in his face.
Mm-hmm.
He is screaming his triumph at the same time he's dying inside. And I want that to be seen in his eyes.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not there.
Right.
And I'm frustrated by that.
Sure.
Because I really want that to be there. And I want these conflicts to be visible.
Well, it's interesting that you found this one little part of the war that you wish you'd drawn.
I find there's a lot of points of it I do wish I'd drawn, because there's a lot of character notes. The bits I miss drawing are the character notes, where this, you know, the Andreas and seduction of what's her name?
Elena.
I
thought, spoiler, Simon, we're not there yet.
Well, no, but it's seduction. He's trying to seduce her right now.
Okay,
in the plot.
You.
That I think that could have been done very nicely. I think that would have been a very nice counterpoint during the war. And I really envy that sequence.
Mm-hmm.
I'd have liked it to be bigger, frankly, because I think that's a really nice sort of node of peace in the chaos.
Right.
And it kind of reflects well on the rest of the action to have that, of these two unlikely characters who found each other in wartime. And that would be great. And I prefer to see that than somehow Dante being heroic.
Right.
Because I find Dante's heroism a bit hollow most of the time. Especially if he's shouting about how heroic he is,
right,
or posing as some sort of heroic hero person.
Right.
Anyway.
So also we got some feedback from Barrington Boots.
Oh.
Hello,
Bootsy. Hello, Barrington Boots.
So he was engrossed by the episode as well, and said it was a fascinating listen. He said you sounded very raw about the direction of the story, but he agreed with Colin that you were open and honest, and that was interesting to hear that view.
Mm-hmm.
He does see that at certain points it's kind of tonally all over the place. And he felt on the final, he kind of had a similar read on the final couple pages of the episode,
mm-hmm,
the fight between Dante and Jenna. He felt this was the most evil representation we ever see,
right,
which is, you know, Dante slicing up Jenna. He boots her in the wounded leg, which he says is a very typical baddie move.
Yep.
And he's just standing there with this horrible sneer. And he said, I don't think he looks heroic or at all. I think he looks a lot like his father.
Okay.
So I thought that was very interesting.
That would have been good. That would have been
interesting. Interesting read of that.
Later on, we do kind of reflect the way that other artists draw Dimitri all the time with the cyborganic stuff going on behind his face.
Yeah.
I don't do that, but other people do it. it's not something that you should only really see that in Extremis when he's really upset or angry.
Yeah.
But that would have been my kind of visual take at that point, but to reflect that, because then suddenly you get you're like your father.
The other bit he says he doesn't like is when it goes all a bit George and Lynn with Jenna's top.
Yeah.
We mentioned that.
That's cheesy and cheap. I don't like that at all.
And like us, he loves Burns, but that point was just well off. I don't know if that was written in the script or this was just a Burns thing, but
it's what a choice he made.
It's a choice he made. And he also liked hearing someone described as a complete Waz.
That's short for Wazak, obviously. Yes.
That was Colin was upset on the message board. You didn't say Wazak.
I will try and be the complete.
And Bootsy asks, what is the recommended intense smoky whiskey for the podcast? Inquiring minds are interested.
I can tell you what we're drinking right now.
Yeah, tell them what we're drinking
Which
right
is
now.
A Laphroaig. It's a Laphroaig Kirchhoff, and it is the PX cask from a couple of years ago.
It is very intense.
It's very good. It's got the classic Laphroaig smoke, but it's also got the kind of really strong sherry influence on it. Mm-hmm. It's still relatively young, so it's still got a lot of energy to it. It's not too oaky or too woody.
No.
Which is great.
So that's a good one. If you can get your mitts on that.
Get that
it's much easier for you to get your mitts on these things if you're listening from the UK than it is for us here in the US.
Lucky sods.
And thank you for asking about the whiskey and podcast pairing. It is really lighting a fire under us to get the whiskey and comics as yet unnamed.
Should we announce it?
We already did.
Should we announce what we're going to do?
Oh God, really? Should we?
I don't know. It feels like it would light the fire even more intensely if we actually.
Well, that means we have to get to it like next weekend.
I mean, this has been unplanned for quite a while.
It's true. So just to recap, the idea for the podcast is that we read comics and we pair them with whiskeys. And so we want to read comics that either one or the other of us has always wanted to read but never has, or one that was really important to us. And one week, each episode, one of us picks the comic and the other person picks the whiskey based on their impression of the comic, which they may be coming to for the first time or maybe haven't read in a while.
Yes. So the first comic.
The
first episode, which, and I picked a comic for this quite a long time ago.
You did, yes.
And unfortunately, in light of recent events, has turned out to be a little bit tragic, which is Nemesis the Warlock, written by Pat Mills and drawn by Kevin O'Neill, which is one of my favorite comics of all time, and Edie has not read it. So I wanted to do that one, and then I don't know what Edie's going to choose, and that'll be a surprise.
We'll see,
whiskey goes with it. I have no idea how you could choose a whiskey to go with Nemesis the Warlock.
Well, and while we're here, can we just say, a fond farewell to Kevin O'Neill?
I know. Drink.
And a cheers to Kevin.
The genius that was Kevin O'Neill. My God. What a talent.
Struggle to find words to even.
I can't imagine me. I'm not the same person without Kevin O'Neill because, we all saw Kevin. If you're of my generation, if you saw 2008 when it first came out and you're 7, 8, 9 years old, Kevin O'Neill was just, he twisted your brain into a different shape. And all of us who are fans of 2008, of that generation, we all had the same twisting happen to us. We're all united by that weird common artistic trauma, which is Kevin O'Neill basically messing with our heads. And he did it so brilliantly and so uniquely and so fantastically well all through his career. And really, there's just nothing. There's nobody like him. It's impossible to imagine anyone else. There's a beautiful obituary written by Alan Moore about him. Of course, it's beautifully written. It outlines, a lot of what makes him special. And how important he was to Moore as a collaborator. And it really, I teared up a little bit at the end of that.
Yeah, I'm tearing up with you talking about it right now.
It's remarkable. Anyway,
Kevin O'Neill.
Kevin O'Neill, the great Kevin O'Neill.
Will be remembered and influencing artists that encounter him.
Yeah.
I also just wanted to mention on Twitter, LRG Carter at LRG Carter on Twitter was catching up with the podcast, and he wanted to note that he always thought that the Crest was a woman. And the reason he always thought the voice, we had mentioned this a few episodes ago, that you were surprised the Crest was a woman. He thought the Crest was always a woman because he noticed Dante asking the Crest if it was jealous of his relationship with Jenna. And as the comic is so often relentlessly heterosexual, my words, not Carter's, but that's basically what he said, he assumed the Crest had to be a woman if the Crest was being jealous. Which I always just took that as like just ribbing the Crest, right? But it's a fair point. And I also just wanted to thank a bunch of people who are retweeting us on Twitter and recommending our podcast to other people. We so appreciate you. So thank you to at Lukey Spooks, at Bert Jammin, at GIL Podcast, at Kasukik Writes, at Your Pathel, and at Sweet Night _UK. We appreciate and we see all of you. Thank you so much.
Yes.
So we are... Are we closing the book on Dante for today?
We are.
My goodness. We're closing the book on Dante for today, but we will be back next week with part two of the Romanov Empire.
Some shit's going down.
And we hope you enjoyed our podcast. And if so, please subscribe to it on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. Leave us a ratings and reviews wherever you can. And keep on telling your friends to join our book club. Follow us on Twitter at PodTGDR. And also, we have a new Instagram account, which is also at PodTGDR. So find us on Instagram. We're going to try and post some more behind-the-scenes stuff.
We're not sure if Twitter's going to exist next week.
Right, yeah. Twitter's getting a little shaky, so I figured it was a good time to bring out Instagram. We're going to have some kind of behind-the-scenes stuff there of how we make this. That's the idea. Let us know what you think of the podcast of Dante Comics, whatever is on your mind through these various social channels. I'm Edie.
And I'm Simon.
And we will catch you next time.
Bye. Thank you.